Now we turn to Bill Resnick and John Foran.
Hi, John Foran. Welcome to KABU.
Thanks, Bill.
John Foran is a scholar activist, teaches at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He writes a good deal on the revolutionary process and climate justice. His writing can be found on the website resilience.org. Here are some of the courses. I'll name some that he teaches: Earth in Crisis, Radical Social Change, Climate Justice, Globalization, Resistance, and his latest, Hope That Works. You get the idea of what he's up to. These courses attempt to, in part, dispel the gloom and doom that quite a few environmental writers have fallen into. And partly, he and his students explore the politics and struggle and reconstruction of how we produce and live, that, of course, reconstruction is necessary to save the planet. His students then try to figure out, well, what is to be done about climate change? John Foran, tell us about why there's so much gloom and why really hope is the right approach. And after that, we can get into politics.
Okay, I think that's very well put, and thank you for that introduction, Bill. I'm just a person living in the 21st century, aware that the humanity now faces the greatest existential threat that it ever has, namely the depth of the climate crisis. And it's not news to talk about it in those terms. The science has been telling us this fairly insistently and consistently. And yet we see that the tide is not turning, but we're still on a path that leads us in completely the wrong direction. And that's why I think any sort of person who looks with any care into writing on the topic basically has a fairly gloomy outlook. And I think that's a fair outlook to have. I come at it from the point of view of a scholar activist interested in, you know, a better world, transforming the world in direction of more equality, more participation, less violence, and, of course, less severe climate disruption. And thus, I see the climate justice struggle as potentially the turning of the tide in humanity's long struggle to live in a way that is really dignified of us. And thus, because of all these crises being interconnected, the economy, the lack of confidence in our political leadership, the culture of violence, all the way from militarism to the most intimate relationships in the family tied together and exacerbated by climate change, I think that the climate crisis and the sort of tight deadline we're on to make deep and quick cuts in greenhouse gas emissions puts us on track to either come out of this in a world we want to live in or in a world that everybody's gloomy about.
You write about active hope, and that if we just sort of have hope and aren't active, then it's just a comforting illusion. But active hope is another matter, and active hope means politics. It means struggle. You've looked at revolutions around the world. It would really take a revolution in the sense of changing pretty much everything of how we produce and live, and it would mean a enormous diminution of the capitalist part of the economy. Maybe they could keep selling comic books digitally, but almost all of production, of material production, would have to radically change, and they don't want to do it. I don't think we can go into too much of why they don't want to do it. It's obvious reasons. And they also, though, have a plan for doing it. They've now focused on geoengineering. That's going to save them, along with producing more renewable energy, but gradually implementing it. Anyway, John, why don't you talk a little bit about capitalism and how it operates, and then we can get into a politics of, in fact, challenging and defeating the Leviathan.
Well, the most succinct way to put it is, as others have, that you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. And so we face real questions of resources, not just energy, but also all of the things that are required for industrial production and also the industrial form of agriculture that we have now. On the other hand, the coming transition to renewable forms of energy is coming rather slowly. It's not being aided by the governments of the world particularly, and it's not being aided by the largest corporations of the world, the big fossil fuel companies. So capitalism is really at a loss. I think this is an insurmountable conundrum for an economic system that's based on growth at all costs. And so I don't know if theoretically one could rearrange capitalism in a way that we could reduce emissions to the degree that we have to and make that transition and leave fossil fuels in the ground. I suppose, as you say, if we had the political will to do that, we might be able to do that. But the kind of changes that are required are such that in the end, at the end of the day, I think if we cut emissions, went renewable, degrew, literally reduced the scope of production and consumption to a manageable level, we wouldn't have anything resembling capitalism anymore. And so, of course, there are many people thinking very creatively about alternatives to capitalism.
This is Bill Resnick for the Omo Variety Hour. I'm talking to John Foran, who teaches and writes and demonstrates. His course include Climate Justice and Practical Hope. We just concluded that hope is really the only defensible stance towards climate change. Then comes the hard questions. What do we do to displace the people who are now running the world? In fact, the entire world is now capitalist and trying to desperately grow and consume more and does not want to stop. Well, how do we displace them seems to be the question. And what would be the process of displacement as climate change gets worse? That's part of it. People will awaken at some point, or at least be far more ready to listen to us. I mean, masses of people. Our movements are growing. John, tell us your ideas about that.
To be perfectly honest up front, Bill, I'll tell you what I tell my classes. These are large questions to which humanity has yet to find answers. And by that, I mean we in the climate justice movement, we're still looking for new ways of doing things. The same is true of the more politically organized political parties around the world. None of them are adequate to the task. And the good news is that some are working on that problem. And ultimately, it's my view that there's going to be some kind of a new synthesis between social movements pushing in the right direction and people that understand that both that we need to contend with the question of political power on the national level in many, many places, but that the parties as we know them are not adequate vehicles for doing that. And so we're going to have to somehow come together with what I like to call rather vaguely, but optimistically, a new kind of party. I mean, I can see that much, that if what you're doing right now is not working, you have to see that as the issue. That's the problem itself. It has to be worked on directly. And one way to do that, of course, as a scholar, is to do that in your research and in your teaching. And so I try and track hopeful experiments around the world, whether they be in the political realm or whether they be in the realm of creating transitional alternatives to what we have now that are appropriately sustainable and democratic and offer hope in that sense. And there are many, many of those.
It seems to me there are people and movements, there are groups and organizations that in fact have solved the problems of how to reconstruct the economy in agriculture, in transport, in material production, in food, in city form, in habitation, and the lifeways in our population centers and in the countryside. It seems to me we have alternatives. There are people working on those alternatives. It seems to me we just have to get them better known. And why don't you be part of that process of getting them better known, like the Transition Cities movement that you've been involved with, actually? Tell us about it.
I agree with that very much. The problem is not that we don't have solutions and we don't have networks and organizations that are inspiring all over the world. It's a question of more people knowing about them, more people being attracted to them, and they themselves trying to solve some of the issues that arise when you go from some success in your community or on a local level to higher levels, which has to happen. And I'm going to recommend to all of the listeners right now that they go look for a film that I show in my class. It's called Demain, the French word for tomorrow, D-E-M-A-I-N, Demain, which until quite recently was not available anywhere on the web. But I discovered just last week that if you go to Amazon, you can rent or buy it. And this covers the Transition Town movement, which you referred to, which is a growing movement of communities that started in the United Kingdom, has spread to the United States and some 40 countries, of communities trying to take control of self-sufficiency in energy and food provision in their carbon footprint, and to do that in a very engaging, intergenerational, inclusive way, which has its own particular flavor wherever it happens. So the Transition Town movement is a place to look. You can look up eco-villages. You can look up a perspective coming out of Europe called degrowth, which says that we have to consume less and that, in fact, there's tons of ways to consume less.
In those transition cities, I think we have to get down really concrete in order to do what they call somehow public education, to get ordinary people to appreciate that it's really possible to create that better greenhouse gas emission-free world and a new forms of production, and to see it themselves. It seems to me that transition cities and all over the world, even in cities that are not trying to be transition cities, but neighborhoods or people or groups of people are creating cooperatives, basically, of one kind or another that, in fact, have implemented these technologies, like solar panels, for example, and arrays of solar panels, both small installations and somewhat larger ones, but not only capital is producing these huge wind farms that also require huge grids and expensive security, as well as the expense to the environment of building these superhighways for electrons. They're more expensive than superhighways for cars. It seems to me we have those examples. Why don't you talk about, you know, some of them to show that it, in the concrete, it's just there waiting for us to implement if we, in fact, put the resources into it.
Yes. I mean, go and find Dumas online and see many examples from around the world that will be much more eloquent, because you'll hear the actors speaking for themselves. They're taken from countries. Some are found in the United States. In the Bay Area, they find a facility that takes household waste and creates compostable earth for farmers. They find a company in France that makes paper and does it in a completely what's called the circular economy, where they use the waste material that they generate to heat the factory. There's so many new and clever ways to rethink all of this, to redesign our economic life. And the thing is that as you do that, you acquire skills that give you confidence. You make friends with neighbors and others that have become rich relationships. You bring up a new generation that is able to think in new ways that are far freer and more creative. All of these things can be very synergistically interrelated. And the thing is, you have to start somewhere. You have to get your feet wet. So you can start very small. I mean, it's called Transition Towns, and they have tremendous materials on their website, the Transition Towns, ustransitiontown.org, I believe. And they call transition streets. It can start as simply as getting a couple of neighbors together and starting a conversation. And it takes effort. It takes time. It takes desire.
It's also sort of a social process that can be really inspiring and pleasurable. Let me tell you a little bit about Portland and our listeners. We have just put on the ballot in the city of Portland, in a state that's done far less than either California or Washington as to climate change. We are really laggards. But in this city, a group formed to put on the ballot an initiative, the Portland Clean Energy Fund, would raise $30 million, but it would create models of clean energy in neighborhoods. And you should really look up that site. It's being supported by the Sierra Club and the Audubon Society and the bigger organizations in this city, as well as many, many smaller ones. And lots of people in the homeless and poor communities support it because it's promising decent, good work for ordinary people. It's going to be on the November ballot. We just turned in our signatures. It shows what can be done. It's a pittance, really. But that's there. That's how you start, and showing a community that they can actually reconstruct themselves. John Foran, it was really good talking to you. Thanks a lot. Keep up the good work.
Same to you. Go Portland.
So long.
Take care.
You're trying to tell me capital has won at last. Anyone who's not convinced has just been shown the door. You're trying to tell me competition turns the wheels. Smart money never deals in welfare anymore. Survival of the fittest keeps the species strong. Change is always painful, but it doesn't last too long. Excuse me, friend, I think you could be wrong. When some of us are free to rise and some are free to fall, all of us are under the dictatorship of capital. You're trying to tell me profit is the bottom line. Cancer is sometimes benign. It eats the cells that leave themselves defenseless. You're trying to tell me market forces must prevail. Some succeed while others fail. Failure has to face the consequences. Weeding out the weak is Mother Nature's song. Existence is a game like chess, Monopoly, or Mahjong. Excuse me, friend.